From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Down Syndrome Awareness Day, which we celebrate this week, aims to shed light on the joys and challenges facing families who receive trisomy 21 diagnoses. Developmental psychologist Mary O'Callaghan has experienced this firsthand as a mother and in her professional research. She joins us today. Then we turn to the dire situation in Haiti, where gangs have taken control of the capital, Port-au-Prince. Father Luis Mirazny, pastor of the Cathedral of St. Anne in Anse-Avu, roughly 80 miles west of Port-au-Prince, describes for us the fright and yet the faith of the Haitian people. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Executive Director of the National Catholic Register and Catholic News Agency. I'm your host here on Register Radio, joined by my co-host, Matthew Bunsen, who is EWTN News' Vice President and Editorial Director based in Washington, D.C. Bureau. So March 21st is the 13th International Down Syndrome Awareness Day. It's established by the United Nations. And sadly, what we're seeing in these days is that 90% sometimes of women who receive diagnosis that their unborn babies have Down syndrome are choosing to have an abortion. And it's estimated that there are approximately 3,000 to 5,000 children who are born with this disorder. So we have a lot of education to do, and we have asked Dr. Mary O'Callaghan, a developmental psychologist at the University of Notre Dame, to join us today. She has focused on studying developmental disabilities. She's worked on ethical and policy issues related to individuals with disabilities, but in particular, she's studied prenatal diagnosis and disability selective abortion. In her policy work, she's testified at state legislatures in support of bans on disability selective abortions, but she's also stood before the United Nations and testified on the concerns of abortions of children with Down syndrome throughout the world. So Mary is not only an expert, but she's also a mother who has welcomed and loved her own son who has trisomy 21, Down syndrome. So, Mary, it seems like God has given you a particular gift here with your studies, but also with this personal experience. So welcome to our show. It's so good to be speaking with you.
Thank you so much, Jeanette. I'm very glad to be here.
So you, as I mentioned, you are the mother of Tommy. This is your 15-year-old who has been diagnosed with Down syndrome and autism. I'm wondering how this experience, this lived experience as a mother, has impacted your academic work as well as your advocacy.
Absolutely, Jeanette. Actually, Tommy just turned 16.
Oh, great.
And I give credit for all of the work I do in this area to my son. I started working in the field of disability in the late 80s, and I came to graduate school here at Notre Dame because there was a Center for the Study of Developmental Disabilities in the psych department. After getting my degree, I worked in the field for a few years, but then I took some time off to raise my children. And so I was out of the field for a while, but in God's providence, he brought me back in a way I never expected. Tommy's our youngest, and when he was born, after dealing with his immediate medical challenges, the hardest thing for my husband and I was the realization that the majority of children like him, if diagnosed in utero, lost their lives to abortion. Mm-hmm. And I was heartbroken at the loss of lives of these beautiful infants who I knew looked just like my son, but also for their parents who choose abortion, right? I'm convinced that they had no idea of the gift that they had been given. And coincidentally, Tommy was born in 2007, and this was the same time that the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists recommended that all pregnant women, not just those over 35, be given prenatal screening. So at that time, there was a heightened worry among parents of children with Down syndrome about what this would mean, right, for the Down syndrome community as we lost more lives, right, to abortion. And so I had a dear friend at the time. She was the president of our local Down syndrome support group, and she encouraged me to use my background to do something about this. So I'll always be so grateful to her. So I started researching and talking to anyone who would listen, and I had the good fortune of being connected to the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture here at Notre Dame, where I had a platform to do this work. So honestly, without Tommy, I wouldn't have done any of the work that I now do.
Yes, I mean, this professional energy that you've been able to give to those with disabilities and studying this and really advocating is a tremendous work. And of course, you can't do it without the help of a community. But also you're building on the legacy of others too. And I'm reminded of Dr. Jerome Lejeune, a medical doctor who spent his life studying children with Down syndrome. He discovered the genetic cause of the disability, the extra chromosome that we now call trisomy 21. He's really just a pioneer, and at the Register we've studied, you know, his life quite a bit. But tell us more of his legacy and how you might be building on that.
Absolutely. I'm so grateful for this question, Jeanette, because after Tommy, Jerome Lejeune has been my biggest inspiration. I have his picture in my office, and I think I've referred to him in every single talk I've ever given. For all of us working in this area, his courage in fighting for children with Down syndrome, I think, is his biggest legacy. As you know, he was tireless in his advocacy for them, even in the face of a lot of persecution, right, in his own country, ostracism in the international medical community, et cetera. But he also showed us how to fight. While he was fiercely protective of his beloved patients, he was unfailingly gracious, right? And he spoke the truth with great love. He was truly, you know, a Christian doctor. Another part of his legacy, though, that I've tried to carry into my own work is his prophetic witness to the field of medicine. He was not afraid to say that the practice of using prenatal diagnosis to select infants for abortion was not medicine at all, right? In fact, one of my favorite quotes of his is that medicine becomes mad science when it kills the patient rather than treating the disease. But the beautiful thing here is that he doesn't leave us without hope either. His work shows us the way forward in medicine, that prenatal diagnosis can be used as a starting point for treatment, right, for good care, for support of both mother and child. So his legacy is enormous, right, both in terms of my own work and in terms of the whole field of prenatal diagnosis.
Yeah, that term of prenatal diagnosis, sadly we're seeing in prenatal testing and diagnoses a direct threat to the existence of children with Down syndrome and other disabilities. What's happening here is a form of eugenics, isn't it? And I know
Absolutely.
You've been involved in state legislative efforts to protect infants with disabilities, but this is a global problem too, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. No, in fact, it's probably worse in European countries. Here in our country, we say the rate's probably between about 70 and 90%, but in much of Europe, in China, in parts of Australia, it's closer to 90% or above.
Yes, it's I wanted to step back for a brief second because you were talking about Jerome Lejeune, and I did want to mention, because we're all Catholics here, there's something exciting about his life, too, is that he is on the road to sainthood. He is a venerable, and that's a really beautiful thing, and so much of that has to do with the way he lifted up the dignity of the human person in this work. So I couldn't miss that moment.
Absolutely, and he'll truly be a saint for our time, and he is much needed, right? So, I'm so grateful.
Yes. So I wanted to talk, I mean, as you mentioned, you and Matthew were talking about this prenatal testing. You know, I've had kids older in life. I've gone through that testing through the tragedy of hearing of a diagnosis and of losing a child. So I know what that feels like personally, but I find there's a huge need for education on this. Where do you start, Mary?
Absolutely. There's so much here, Jeanette, because the evidence is overwhelmingly in favor of carrying children with Down syndrome to term. It would take, about a good hour to lay this all out. So let me just give you some brief highlights. It's really important to point out that women who receive a prenatal diagnosis are very vulnerable, right? Your experience shows this, both anecdotal evidence as well as preliminary research shows that a significant percentage of women feel pressure, right, to have first the testing and then the abortions. And they often do so without good information about Down syndrome. And even though we've been doing prenatal testing, screening, et cetera, for a long time, there's still much confusion, I think, about the intent of prenatal screening and diagnosis, I don't think women truly understand, right, where this is going to lead them. Most women, if asked, will say they get tested, right, for the health of the baby, right, of course. But when they receive a diagnosis of Down syndrome, for example, they suddenly realize that help was never really offered, right? The only way to sort of achieve health at that point is to get rid, right, to terminate the life of the so-called unhealthy child, right? And so they feel very much backed into a corner at this point. And many women who would never choose abortion otherwise make this choice. It seems like the only one, right, that they can make. Women also don't realize that insurance companies, right, and any state-funded medical programs don't pay for screening out of benevolence, out of concern for them or their child. They do so because research has shown that it's cost-effective. It costs less to screen for and abort children with Down syndrome than it does to have them in the healthcare system.
So sad.
So, absolutely. So parents need to know that the medical system, right, at least as far as the sort of diagnostic process goes, is not on the side of their child. It is not about the health of their child. Now, obviously, there are some exceptions to this in terms of, you know, infants who are diagnosed with things that can be treated in utero, but these exceptions at this point are pretty rare, right? So parents need to be aware of this, right, that this is, they need to know this before they start the testing process, that this is where it's headed.
I want to ask you a question.
Oh, go ahead.
These people are not alone, and you've worked to co-founded a group called Miriam's Blessings, a diocesan perinatal hospice program that's super important for support. Where can people turn? I mean, there are groups like this, but are there more?
Absolutely. So our group, Miriam's Blessing, was created using a model, a national model called Be Not Afraid, which is a national Catholic perinatal hospice program, probably the gold standard for perinatal hospice in our country, I think. And they have grants for training for other dioceses, so other dioceses can establish this. A number of dioceses have already gone through this training program and have these programs available. If you look on the National Perinatal Hospice website, there are lists of perinatal hospice programs. So there are also a number of, you know, secular perinatal hospice programs out there in communities, which are very good. I think maybe the best way to find a local support if you're looking for it would be to contact Be Not Afraid, and they can help, you know, connect you with some support in your community.
I will also mention you're going to be speaking with others on a panel called Prenatal Diagnoses and the Future of Down Syndrome. This is on Tuesday, March 19th at 2 p.m. Central. This is a partnership of the National Catholic Partnership for Disabilities and the Institute for Human Ecology at Catholic University of America. And you can find information on that at www.ncpd.org. And there you can find this event. So, Dr. Callahan, Mary Callahan, it's so great to be speaking to you. Thank you for this wonderful information, and may God continue your good work.
Thank you so much, Jeanette.
When we come back, we hear from a Haitian priest who is seeing violence consume his country. Where do they find their hope? This is Register Radio on EWTN. Stay tuned for more.
Sacrifice is a profound virtue Catholics can lovingly embrace, especially during Lent. But this year, why not also indulge in something good for your soul? Give yourself the gift of EWTN's National Catholic Register and stay connected to the latest developments and historical traditions of our Catholic faith. Save half off your subscription today. Get the National Catholic Register delivered to your home, office, or parish, filled with spiritual insights on world events, along with compelling Catholic news and information. To get 50% off your subscription, order online at ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code radio. The National Catholic Register. It's the one indulgence you won't ever want to give up. Call or click today to save half off. The National Catholic Register. Read faithfully.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Executive Director of the National Catholic Register and Catholic News Agency. I'm joined by my co-host here on Register Radio, Matthew Bunsen. So since early March, anarchy really has reigned in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, after gangs broke into a prison, freeing 3,500 prisoners. These are gang members, and thus fortifying their troops and taking control of the whole, almost the whole city. They've closed ports and airport. It's really quite a mess, and the world is watching on. Last Monday, the acting prime minister resigned, and he sought to establish a transitional council to govern, but so far the gangs have threatened the existence of that council. So there are really dire straits there in Haiti. We are gratefully joined by a Haitian priest, Father Luis Merzoni, and he's the pastor of the Cathedral of St. Anne in Ansavu, which is on the northern coast of the southern peninsula of Haiti. It's, let's say, roughly 80 or so miles from Port-au-Prince. He now joins us from Miami. Welcome, Father.
Thank you very much, Jeanette. Good to be with you.
So I know you're in Miami now, but you are in very close contact with the people of Haiti, with your own cathedral parish. Tell us about the situation in your town, where your parish is.
Sure. My town is more or less peaceful, actually, and more or less safe, because our whole region, in fact, the region of Nieps, has been considered one of the safer regions because of good vigilance, collaboration between different authorities, good prosecutor that we have there, and the collaboration has to go with the church. And so when we see something, we say something, and that allows the proper authorities to act on the information quickly. And so that has allowed us to not have gangs actually take hold in our region. And so as such, we're safe, if you will, more or less. However, we feel the great impact of everything happening. I mean, nowhere, Haiti is a small country, and nowhere is quite completely dispensed of the feeling of lack of safety, and also not knowing where these almost 4,000 prisoners have gone, because they probably won't all stay in Port-au-Prince. There might be some that try to escape to go further back into their own hometowns, if you will, and so we're vigilant with that as well. Yet our schools are still functioning, whereas, unfortunately, in Port-au-Prince, many schools cannot function, which is a very sad thing that happens when there are crises like this. The students usually suffer, and so they are set back in their education. But our schools, the Catholic schools at least, we try our best to keep up, even though we don't have much means to run them, but we will run them until we run to the ground.
Yes, and it's such a dire situation there in the country's capital. We spoke EW10 News nightly, a partner television show of the Register, spoke to Stephen Destin. This is a man who is executive director of a program that helps the Catholic schools, the ones that you're talking about, and Catholic churches as well as hospitals. He's right outside of Port-au-Prince, and he just described this. This is a quote: "We keep hitting rock bottom, but afterward we find out that there's a sub-level of rock bottom, and we keep digging ourselves through." So, I mean, why does this keep happening? Why it's been almost 3 years, really, that there's been a great amount of instability, and now it's really reached a pinnacle. Why is this happening?
Yeah. Okay. So to the question of why, that's a complicated question with a very complicated answer, which I do not claim to have all the parts to. However, it's interesting that Stephen uses that language as exactly the language I use. I keep thinking that, okay, this is the rock bottom. That's the worst it's going to get, and then it gets worse, and it's a surprise. But yeah, I never lose hope, actually, because I believe that Christ reigns, and the Haitian people, they are an amazing people, and with a spectacular history. Haiti is the first black republic. It's the only nation to be formed by a slave rebellion and fighting against the undefeated army of Napoleon Bonaparte, and declared independence in 1804, being the second country in the Western Hemisphere to be independent, second only after the U.S. And so we've done a lot of amazing things, not only for ourselves, even for other people, such as rescuing runaway slaves from Latin America and paying money to ship captains to bring them back home and giving them citizenship immediately as they touch the soil. So we've got a history of greatness. So this is, to go back to the why, and it's, by the way, the problem is not just starting 3 years ago. There's a lot that goes further down, even with poverty. For example, after we defeated France, as the New York Times pointed out, and many Haitian authors have pointed out and others, they came back with warships years later and threatened to get back to war unless we pay an independent debt or reparations for the losses of the slave owners. And Haiti kept paying every single year and never defaulted until recently. And France keeps receiving that money and then now closes its eyes, pretends that it never did. Well, I mean, it knows it did. It doesn't say that it didn't. It just doesn't want to return that money, for example. Can you imagine what, in today's currency, it's over $20-something billion in today's currency that we had to pay for reparation for slave owners. Now, I think they should return that. We're not asking for reparation, just the return of the reparation that we were forced to pay, right? So taking so much money from a dying country after war, trying to build itself up, is never setting it up for success.
And in fact, sure.
So that they can point the finger later on and say, see, you should never have cut ties from us. And just like people are using that today for other colonies in the Caribbean, telling them, you don't really want independence. Look what happened to Haiti. Okay, so that's one really important thing that's to remember. Having said that, there are other international occurrences that happen that put pressure on Haiti. For example, the embargo in the 90s that wiped out the, the embargo certainly wiped out the economy, but another one is the flooding of rice into the country. That was strategically done, which completely wiped out the rice industry in Haiti, so that we can't really grow our own rice because we couldn't compete with the American rice that was flooding for really almost nothing. It was almost free rice. And the people were hungry, and so, of course, they jumped to it. And then, of course, when the rice industry was wiped out, well, then the price of rice rose up. And now people can't afford the rice. But the industry was already destroyed. And so, and there are leaders, even Clinton, who sort of apologized for these things that happened. However, I don't want to put the blame only on international actors. There are local actors that are corrupt people. Corrupt government leaders who want only power for themselves, who are looking out for their pockets and their family members, and they are taking forcibly from a country that has richness, that has wealth, but that which we cannot exploit, unfortunately. But the greatest wealth of Haiti is its people, and people and the leaders are abusing such a beautiful people with such an amazing culture. And so because of the corruption.
And faith, yeah.
And a faith, and an amazing faith. And I want to get to that part.
Yes.
The church has not been immune to the violence, has it?
Absolutely not.
You're in Miami with your archbishop who has been harmed in the violence or in this terrible fire. So I want you to tell us about the faith of the people. How is the church helping?
The faith of the people is incredible. And just to give you a little anecdote, after the 2021 earthquake, not the 2010 earthquake, which killed over about 300,000 people, but the 2021 earthquake also killed thousands, but not as many. That one actually destroyed many houses in our region, and it damaged my cathedral. We're still meeting outside. We're still meeting under a metal tent after years. And I'm glad you spoke to Destin, because their structure is supposed to help churches and schools, the construction of churches and schools, by the way. And they need to look our way. So I'm glad. I hope Destin is listening. But after the earthquake, I was so touched. The next Sunday, as people's houses were in rubbles, and they had to literally dug through rubbles to get their clothes and their few belongings that were not much to begin with, but they cleaned up and dusted off their things and then packed the church to come worship to give thanks to God for the gift of life. And that is so beautiful and so indicative of the Haitian faith and resilience. They were not there shaking their fists at God. They know that natural disasters happen, but they realize that God is with them no matter what. And in fact, that's the only thing that explains the existence of this people beyond all the sufferings, all the natural disasters, and all the political disasters, all the gang disasters, earthquakes of corruption that were still standing. And so the church is indeed present, although the church used to be sort of the religion of the day, if you will, because there's some stability because of a concordat that was signed between the Holy See and the Haitian state. In fact, the Holy See was the first state to recognize Haitian independence early on. And so there's beautiful gratitude there and good relationship. However, the church, I think, got comfortable, and the church sort of was riding on that recognition that, hey, most people are Catholic in Haiti, until they realized, oh, there's other people that are actually persuading others or using tactics to get Catholics out of the church. And so we can't just ride on that. We need to actually evangelize. We need to stand and proclaim the good news. But nonetheless, the church goes where the state cannot go. The church is everywhere, in every single village, to be present with the people through its priests that live poorly, that don't have a salary, and yet that give their lives for the sake of the gospel. And that's one reason why I wanted to go back, and I was called to go back after studying in the U.S., to be amongst this amazing group of people serving the beautiful, beloved poor of Jesus Christ. And so the church is also attacked. Yes, you're right, recently at least. It used to not be so, but recently nuns, priests are getting kidnapped, brothers are getting kidnapped, and like you said, my bishop was in an explosion, was still trying to figure out if it was criminal or accidental. But, you know, we're keeping our eyes wide open because we know that it would not be beyond our situation for that to be criminal.
Right. Well, Father Morozny, we will continue and call for prayer for the people of Haiti, for a resolution to this terrible violence. But we know most of all we'll join in prayers for the rebuilding of the church, which can help provide stability. I encourage our listeners to go to ncregister.com, read the story, Haiti Reaches a Sub-Level of Rock Bottom. We invite our listeners also to go to NC Register for more news, analysis, and commentary. Please check out the Register at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us on EWTN, together with Matthew Bunsen and today's producer, Michael McCall. I'm Jeanette DeMello, and I pray that until next week, God blesses you.